With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365 Sports Car Racing Podcast in Indianapolis. I'm Ryan Marine with John DeGeese joining me from Chicago as we get set to mostly dive into the news of the week in sports car racing. We did have some sports car racing over the weekend, most notably Super GT, also the British GT Silverstone 500 event and associated events took place, and a whole lot more, and we do have results for those races either in standalone stories or as part of the weekly racing roundup, and you can find that up at sportscar365.com. But with so much going on in the news, let's go ahead and get into that right away here, John, and starting with a story that came out just before we started recording this, actually, on Monday morning, with some quotes from the folks at Orica talking about really gauging the marketplace on LMDH. And while it's been quiet as far as official announcements, we've known that there were about a dozen or so manufacturers involved in working groups behind the scenes. What we didn't know was how interested they are, and specifically how that interest has changed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But at least based on what Orica is hearing, John, it sounds like there is a great deal of positivity with the potential programs still being considered by a wide array of different manufacturers.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems as though that interest has actually increased since the pandemic, and that's something that you never really would have imagined. But that's all indications from Orica. I spoke to Anthony Megavan, the director of customer support, customer racing for the manufacturer, and he's involved in a lot of these discussions too, alongside David Florian and Hugues de Schoeneck. So he told me that it's, you know, they've been talking to one or two additional manufacturers in the last few weeks that have sort of come along that wasn't part of the initial roundtable pre-COVID. And we knew there were about 12 or 13 manufacturers that were in discussions with the ACO and IMSA before the pandemic started. And I think the only manufacturer that sort of dropped out of that roundtable has been Lamborghini. I think we've mentioned it before that they haven't been able to commit to a program and so forth. They've sort of been taking a back seat on that. But all indications are that every other manufacturer, including Ford, for that matter, are still engaged in discussions. The interesting thing that sort of came to light with my talk with Anthony is that manufacturers are looking at different timelines of entry. So they're all not looking to enter right at the beginning, whether that's the end of 22 or early 2023. There's some programs that could be coming online in 2024 or even 2025. And so if there's enough space spread out between these programs, a constructor like Orica can support additional manufacturers. So while we only have really one manufacturer that sort of indicated down this path, that's Acura, when it was announced that Meyer Shank Racing and Wayne Taylor Racing was going to be taking over that program, the existing DPI program in the WeatherTech Championship starting next year. Acura signaled intentions of moving into the LMDH era when that begins. We don't have anybody else officially confirming yet, but we do know there's others in the pipeline, and this development, this news from Orica stating that there's additional manufacturers that have now shown interest, definitely gives some great momentum for this platform.
What do you think is at the root of this continued interest? Because I think the conventional wisdom would have been, you look at car sales right now, and it's not really looking positive from a car maker's perspective, with really no end in sight at the moment. I mean, we see a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's a little unclear where that is relative to when this pandemic comes to a close. So what is it about LMDH that still looks attractive when you would think, at least from the outside, this would not be the time to be starting a brand new motorsports program?
Well, there's two answers to that. So one is the cost-effective nature of this platform. So we're talking costs, you know, less than a GTLM program or GTE, something, you know, it could be done as cheap as a GT3 program, for that matter, especially if you're an existing GT3 manufacturer. You can use a GT3 engine, you know, potentially, and then upstage it in some power. It's a spec hybrid, our trains, so there's no development cost there. And then you'd have to create the bodywork, which does what would bring in some costs. But, you know, a manufacturer can come in and do this for under $10 million U.S. dollars and be competitive and have a brand out there and potentially sell cars to customers. And that's another unique angle here that we got confirmed from Orica is that, you know, there's manufacturers that are looking for full factory efforts, like Porsche, for instance. We presume that would be a full factory effort should they commit. Then there's manufacturers looking for like a semi-works operation, similar to what we see right now with the Cadillacs, or what we had seen with the Cadillacs, at least with Wayne Taylor and Action Express. The Cadillac program very well may be moving into more of a full-on customer program next year in the WeatherTech Championship. But then there's also the customer racing opportunities for LMDH like that. So I think it gives manufacturers multiple options, and I think that's a very attractive point as well.
Well, it's obviously great to hear that the interest remains, but I do think there is still a pretty broad gulf between manufacturers kicking the tires and expressing interest, whether privately or publicly, and actually going through with these LMDH programs. And I mean, I go back to DPI because the first couple of years of DPI, it always seemed like there was something bubbling behind the scenes and we were going to have something new come on. But really, after the initial rollout, all that joined later was Acura, despite all of the interest that we had heard about from people like Hyundai and Ford and you name it behind the scenes, right? So what can the WEC and IMSA do to try and help this along and ensure that they can convert the stated interest of these OEMs into actual on-the-track programs that they can build their series around for years to come?
Well, I think a lot of the big issue we had with manufacturers not committing for, say, the year two or year three of DPI was the fact that there was already talk of the next generation DPI 2.0, which has now morphed into LMDH. So that stalled a lot of the talks, including Ford. I think that was one of the main players that was pretty much ready to go for a DPI program for this year, this calendar year in the WeatherTech Championship for 2020. They had given commitments to their drivers. They had given commitments to Ganassi. And then all of a sudden, by June of last year, it was all off. And that was more or less due to the evolving regulations with LMDH and uncertainties there and when the new DPI 2.0, which turned into LMDH, would debut. So I think we have a clearer path now where the ACO, FIA, IMSA have laid out the time frame for LMDH. Again, we don't know if it'll be late 22 or early 23 when the platform will debut, but we have commitments from WEC that this will be a global platform. The only other potential block in the road is LMH, the hypercar class, which is, oddly enough, gaining a bit of momentum as well. We had Peugeot confirm their plans back at Le Mans. There's apparently other manufacturers that are now weighing a program between LMDH or LMH. I think Hyundai is one of them. Alpine could be another one as well. So it is interesting that LMH could actually be a detriment to LMDH in some ways. And then there's also still the uncertainty if LMH would be allowed inside IMSA. But I think if you have a manufacturer as big as Hyundai commit to an LMH program, for instance, instead of LMDH, I think IMSA would have to let them in somehow. But I guess the best way to put this is that this is all just a bunch of talk right now. And there aren't any really meat on the bones just yet. But seeing that there is additional interest, I think, is definitely a positive development.
Without a doubt, it beats the alternative, and that's what I was afraid we might be hearing, is that manufacturers would be stepping away given the challenges that they're facing in the automotive market right now. But it does sound positive. That is good, and hopefully that it builds to something more for the future. So from LMDH to LMH now, and Peugeot, which we know will be taking part in an LMH program in the future. I thought this was interesting. They're planning to leverage EV experience from within the PSA group, and that includes the DS Taichita Formula E team. So really interesting there, leaning on some of the electric car technology that they have from the Formula E program, DS Taichita, now, and trying to roll that into what they have planned for their LMH program.
Yeah, this is definitely a very serious effort from Peugeot, and we saw it from the trackside activation at Le Mans and all the announcements and opportunities there that were sort of given to them during this year's race. And I think that they're all in on this new LMH program and utilizing every single aspect of their expertise from different areas of motorsports, whether it's Formula E, whether it's World Rally and everything else. So it's very interesting to see this program evolve. And while we haven't gotten any technical details on the powertrain, on what they're doing, this sort of solidifies why they went the LMH route. They wanted to carry over technology from other areas of the sport with Formula E, to help promote their hybridization and electrification of the Peugeot brand. I know there's an all-electric Peugeot that was recently announced for the road. So there's definitely a lot of synergies there, and adding the engineering support, all the expertise they've collected with their Formula E involvement, which is currently with the Tachita. So it's great to see this development for sure as well.
Really fascinating story. Encourage you to check that out at sportscar365.com. Big topic of conversation in IMSA looking ahead to next year is what the GT Le Mans class is going to look like and whether there might be something on the grid outside of Corvette and BMW. I know we've seen the racy Ferrari at times, and possibly we might see a Ferrari from the Scuderia Corsa stable. John, what do we know at this point about their interest as it stands at the moment in perhaps stepping into GT Le Mans to give a little extra boost to that class for 21?
Well, it's an interesting one because nobody's really wanting to comment publicly about their intentions or desires at this point. What we know is that there have been inquiries, there have been evaluations for a GTLM program from Scuderia Corsa with at least one car. We believe it's the WeatherTech backed entry with Cooper McNeil. Whether that's an additional car, maybe Cooper would stay in GTD, and maybe this would be a WeatherTech sponsored effort for GTLM with two pro drivers and maybe a factory driver. We don't know that just yet, but what we do know is that the team is evaluating a potential full season effort, and this is quite frankly due to the lower grid for GTLM next year. We know that Porsche is gone at the end of the season. This weekend's their final race in the GTLM class. Corvette's committed for the full season. BMW said they will come back. We're still waiting on the exact program for BMW next year, whether it'll be a full season or potentially, as rumored in the industry right now, they could potentially have a reduced program. And this is where a privateer team like Scuderia Corsa could capitalize on an opportunity there for GTLM. And we've had conversations with John Doonan before confirming that there's been discussions with teams looking to field cars in GTLM, both with Ferrari and Aston Martin. And we don't particularly know the entrant from Aston Martin right now, but I'm confident in saying that that possibility could come from Scuderia Corsa.
Really interesting stuff there. Back to prototypes. This one, I think we knew something was going to happen with LMH coming on and running at a lower performance level than the LMP1 class has over the years. There was going to need to be an adjustment to LMP2, and we have some clarity finally on this. This seems like a topic we've been talking about for years. We finally know how this is going to be handled, and what I find interesting is the power reduction that LMP2 is facing. That's not just for series that will have LMH running in them next year, namely the FIA WEC, but this is a global power reduction for LMP2.
Yeah, we weren't expecting this initially for IMSA, maybe the team's part, but at least it caught me by surprise, that this is effective in not only the WEC and ELMS, but also Asian Le Mans and the WeatherTech Championship. So it'll be the same specification Gibson engine across the board. And I think what stems from this is the fact that Gibson's having to make some mechanical adjustments to the engine for the power reduction. It was initially thought that it would all be done via electronics only, and from what I understand, there's going to be some mechanical changes with the trumpets and some other components inside the powertrain to reduce the power from 600 to around 560. That was announced last December. And so now this change will also carry over into the WeatherTech Championship. It's unclear exactly how much this will have a change in terms of lap times in the IMSA right now, because the IMSA spec for LMP2 was already restricted to a little bit with a different gearing, an RPM limiter. So the LMP2s were already not running to the full 600 horsepower in the WeatherTech Championship as it was because of some changes that IMSA had made. So it may only be a slight change in terms of lap time performance, but it's still interesting to see that the same specification will be used across the board. This is definitely going to help, you know, European teams looking to come over and run Daytona for the Rolex 24 or additional races and intermingling with other championships within the ACO pyramid. So I'm glad to see this has been confirmed by the ACO, and we had confirmation from IMSA that this is also going to be adopted as well in the WeatherTech Championship. You always want to make sure that you get it confirmed from IMSA as well, because when the ACO announces something, sometimes it takes people by surprise.
Do we have a sense for whether or not the other changes to LMP2 in IMSA right now, namely the mandated gear ratios, will that remain in place next year, or will this power reduction be enough in IMSA's eyes to keep that class separation between DPI and LMP2?
That I don't know yet, and we're still working on following up to get clarification on that, so stay tuned.
All right, very good. Well, one of the teams that will be affected by this, actually, is going to be InterEuropol, who we saw at Motul Petit Le Mans. They'll be back in IMSA for their second IMSA race at the Mobile 1 12 Hours of Sebring this weekend. And, John, I know you spoke to Sascha Fassbender, the team principal there, and they've got plans in addition to what they have planned in Europe to contest three races in the WeatherTech Championship next year.
Yeah, this is another positive development for IMSA. There has always been a lot of questions over what the shape of LMP2 was, and I think we had the story a couple weeks ago that said that, hey, there's going to be between 4 to 7 LMP2 entries projected right now, even though LMP3 is joining into the series. And InterEuropol, it seems to be one of the other additions to this, with the Polish team committing to, so far, provisionally at least, the Rolex 24 at Daytona, the Salem 6 Hours at a Glen, and Motul Petit Le Mans. They cannot do the 12 Hours of Sebring, as that will be on the Super Sebring weekend with WEC. They're fully focused on, not fully focused, but also focused on a full season program in the WEC next year, which is also an addition to what they had previously done. So this is quite some good news, because we weren't exactly sure where this program was going after making their debut at Petit Le Mans last month. It was more or less, you know, renting a car via PR1 Matheson Motorsports, which turned out to be an Era Motorsport Orica chassis. We're still trying to figure out why all that was the case. The best answer I've gotten is it was down to logistics. The team InterEuropol doesn't actually know which chassis they're going to be using this weekend, whether it's a second PR1 chassis or the Era car again. My money's on the Era chassis again, but that's another Anorak thing that probably not a lot of people want to hear about this weekend. bottom line is, we have them again for this weekend at Sebring. They're interested in doing the majority of the endurance races, and they're very close to confirming the Rolex 24, which is great news there. And again, having another European team over in the States is great. You know, and I even asked Sasha about this. It's like, you know, how has it been sort of, you know, going outside of Europe and all this travel? It's like he told me they used the same crew, the same mechanics and whatnot that did the rest of the European Le Mans series. And they threw in Petit Le Mans in between that. And he said they had some travel issues initially. They were denied boarding for the flight out to Road Atlanta on Monday. They had to take the flight the next day. It just goes to show you how crazy everything is in these times. And I really have to give kudos to teams like InterEuropol for actually still persevering and pushing through despite all the stuff that's going on and the challenges of travel during COVID right now.
It's remarkable commitment. And like you said, great to see a nice boost to the LMP2 car count, and looking forward to seeing what they can do at Sebring here coming up this weekend. Final news story to spend some time on, at least extended time on. This actually comes out of the NASCAR championship race that was last night as we record this. Our newly minted NASCAR Cup Series champion, Chase Elliott, who has really turned into an excellent road course racer in stock cars, apparently headed towards the Rolex 24 next year, possibly alongside Jimmy Johnson, the seven-time Cup champion, who's about to embark on an IndyCar career starting next season as well. So their mutual team owner, Rick Hendrick, let loose in the press conference after the race that that these two might be running together with the Rolex, and immediately started to backtrack a little bit, saying, hey, maybe I jumped the gun a little. But it certainly got people's attention, and I'll tell you, if you're IMSA, this is a dream scenario. The most popular driver in NASCAR right now, and the reigning champion in Chase Elliott, and the seven-time champion, one of the greatest in NASCAR history, potentially in your biggest event. That's going to draw a lot of eyeballs if this all comes to fruition.
Yeah, Mr. Hendrick's comments, I think, came as a bit of a surprise, at least the timing of it all. And we've known that that there's always been an active effort to bring all-star drivers to the Rolex 24, and I think there was an effort this year to have a bunch of high-profile NASCAR drivers in a car. Ultimately, it didn't materialize. A similar effort's being done this time around for 2021, and it appears that it will be happening. Chase Elliott confirmed that he is going to do it. He has an agreement, but the contract hasn't been signed yet. He didn't reveal who it's with, but we understand it'll be in an Action Express Cadillac DPI. Whether it's the 31 Whelen car, as they need a third driver or a fourth driver for that matter, as it has not been confirmed alongside Pipo Durrani and the expected return of Felipe Nasr to that lineup. It remains unclear if that's part of that lineup or a second car, but we're fairly confident that Action will field two Cadillacs for the Rolex 24, and it appears that Jimmy and Chase will be part of that lineup. It's also been rumored that Simon Pagenaud could be part of this effort as well, which would be great to see. Simon is no stranger to the team. He raced with them in 2016 as part of their Endurance Cup lineup. Now that Team Penske is no longer in the DPI ranks, it opens the opportunity for him to be part of this. And there's also been some other drivers mentioned that could be part of all this, GM-related drivers as well. So interesting times. Let's wait for some official announcements. But, Jimmy's made no – he hasn't hidden the fact that he would love to do sports car races alongside his IndyCar commitments next year. Unfortunately, I don't think he can do the 24 Hours of Le Mans. I believe that clashes with an IndyCar race, right, Ryan?
Yeah, that does sound right to me. I can't remember which one offhand, but I do think that is the case.
So I think Rolex 24 would be the next best thing for him, at least to get some newer, more recent sports car experience under his belt. He has a bunch of starts in the Rolex 24. I think five previous starts it is. He finished second in 2008 in a Gainsco Bob Stallings Racing entry. But you have to remember, those were first-gen DPs. And the DPIs, which are, which everybody knows are LMP2-based, it's a different kettle of fish. And you just have to ask Jeff Gordon that. So, yeah, exciting development. Let's wait for an announcement, but looks like we have some NASCAR stars, or soon-to-be IndyCar star, Jimmy Johnson, however you want to say it, headed to the 24 in January.
That's going to take some getting used to, and it is the street course race in Detroit that conflicts with the 24 Hours of Le Mans. That's why IMSA is running the week earlier at Detroit, and they're doing the two-week festival, I suppose you could call it. So
it's hard to keep up with all this stuff.
This year more than any other, quite possibly. So plenty more on those stories, plus stories like IMSA and WSC set to collaborate on an endurance BOP for the TCR platform. Also, TGM announcing that it plans to return to Michelin Pilot Challenge next year with a two-car Camaro program. And also a story on Ginetta receiving some interest in its LMP3 offering here in North America. So a lot of sports car racing news and plenty of stories up on sportscar365.com for you to peruse. Let's get to some listener questions now. And the first one came in on Twitter with the hashtag AskDoubleStint, saying, this is from at OnTheFly, by the way, And that this listener said, just listened with interest to our comments on the great comeback by the number 6 and 7 group. That's Acura Team Penske. He says, perhaps a bit cynical, but the timeline on the two mid-year BOP changes does answer a lot, and says, great work on the show. Well, thank you very much for listening. And it's a point well made. I would say I've reached the point where anytime we're talking about success in sports car racing, it's almost implicit that BOP had something to do with it. So rather than pointing that out every time, I think most people realize that that's just the nature of the sport. But you're right. Without a doubt, there were some tweaks, and Team Penske took advantage of it. But I don't know if that's cynical or just realistic, John, right? That's the nature of the sport today.
Yeah, I follow the same path that you have there with that. Also, what you have to remember is that the WeatherTech Championship schedule turned out to be quite a bit different than what it was initially intended. We lost the street races. We lost CTMP. We added a second Daytona race, a second Sebring race, and now we have the big endurance races on the back end of the calendar, races that Penske typically never performed well at. So you sort of now they're performing well and things are headed in a good direction, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of different variables at play. So I wouldn't put it down strictly to the BOP only.
Nevertheless, thank you for writing in, and thanks for the kind words about the show as well. We appreciate the positive feedback. Next question comes from Walt, who says, I'm having trouble with the DTM's move to GT3 equipment. And I don't think you're alone there, Walt. But he says, I get the demise of Class 1, though it seems to be doing well in Japan. And as much as I really like GT3 cars, was this the best move? What are your thoughts about using a TCR format or even copying British touring cars, which no one seems to do, yet they have great racing? He says, your thoughts and perspectives would be greatly appreciated. Really enjoy the podcast and appreciate all the hard work you folks do for sports car racing.
Yeah, I don't understand DTM's logic with this, especially when they put out press material talking about they're moving from standing starts to rolling starts like IndyCar and making things like trying to alienate the rest of the sports car racing world and trying to make it look like they're adopting something brand new, and where in theory they're not. They are adopting, as was confirmed this weekend during their season finale, they're adopting a full GT3 spec car. Their initial idea was to make a modified version of GT3 with more power, no driver aids, yet no manufacturer was willing to support it. Maybe there was only a few, and it wasn't going to be a big enough grid. So they've resorted to basically what was going to be a GT3 Plus, you know, with manufacturer support, now down to full customer GT3 cars that is exactly like ADAC GT Masters. And it's forced GT Masters, meanwhile, to now call their championship an international GT championship, which makes absolutely no sense. It's what we in the US call the MLB World Series. You know, it's not right. Really a World Series. And I just hate calling it like that. I guess you could call it international because they do have a couple races outside of Germany, but still it's frustrating to see this rivalry already kicking off before it even has started between the two championships. And I really think DTM should have gone with a different formula. I don't know much about British touring cars. I know TCR is globally accepted a little bit more. It probably wouldn't have made sense to do TCR, but why could have, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been a solution for this year, but perhaps work with the supercars group in Australia and try to come up with a new formula that could be shared between those two platforms. You know, it's pretty clear that supercars is going down a new route with their next car of tomorrow or whatever you want to call it. And it's clearly a touring car, GT touring car based platform there where it's, a two-door model. I think that would make a lot of sense to work with that group and try to develop a new platform and not just throw GT3 cars into the mix. I understand that GT3 something's needed for next year and there's not much available right now, and it wouldn't have made any sense to adopt the current generation of supercars or the current generation of British touring cars. I think TCR would have been the only alternative, and quite frankly, we have a lot of TCR championships out there right now as well. So it's a tough one. There's no easy answer, but I'm really worried about what this does to the GT3 landscape in Germany right now. And especially when you hear comments from Gerhard Berger talking about, hey, we can have a race at the Nürburgring Nordschleife. There's a possibility there in the future. I'm thinking, like, what are you talking about? Because we have the Nürburgring 24. It makes no sense. And all the VLN races, NLS races. So it's like the GT3 market's already oversaturated as it is in Germany, and this is just going to make it worse.
I think, ultimately, is this the best choice that they had? Probably not, but it was probably the only choice that they had, and they painted themselves into a corner because, against all odds and against the conventional wisdom, they seemed to cling to hope that Class 1 was salvageable. And the Aston Martin project, when it came online, I think gave some false hope that maybe they were in a place where they could weather the storm for a little bit, maybe get the ties to Japan and Super GT a little bit closer, although I think that was a fool's errand too, because it never really seemed like the Japanese manufacturers were all that interested in investing in DTM. So by hanging on to this hope that somehow this Class 1 thing could be salvaged, and then ultimately having the decision forced on them by the Class 1 manufacturers saying, nope, sorry, we're done, they were left in a poor position with basically no time to work with to try and come up with a solution. And it really seems like no thought was put into what this solution was going to be in the time, in the build-up to the announcement that Class 1 was dead, effectively. So they were left really unprepared, at least it seems that way from the outside, and they have to try and pick something. And then, to your point, it's really quite almost comical. If it wasn't sad, it would be, to see them announcing, all right, we're going to do GT3 Plus and all these different things, only to have the manufacturers of these cars say, well, we can't really do that. It's going to cost us a ton of money to go and modify the cars to fit these rules that only work in this one series, the future of which is really up in the air, and they've had to backtrack yet again. I think the one thing that saves them to some degree is they announced their TV package, and it's quite good by all accounts in Germany and puts them in a advantageous position, I think, vis-a-vis GT Masters. And some of that's just the name recognition of DTM. As to why they couldn't go TCR, my read on it at least, and maybe you can weigh in on this, John, is the bread and butter of the series has always been the German manufacturers. And other than Audi, TCR really isn't an option for, say, a Mercedes, for instance.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So anyway, as you could tell, Walt, this one fires us up a little bit. It's been a point of frustration, and DTM has done a lot of things that have not engendered a lot of goodwill over the last few years with the rest of the sports car racing world. So there might be a little schadenfreude going on here, too, with people maybe taking some joy in their struggles, which I don't. I mean, I liked what the DTM had. It was unique. It had great pedigree. But, man, the writing was on the wall for this for a long time. And they were pretty implacable with sticking to Class 1, even when really all the signs pointed to them needing to make some adjustments. So I'm not sure what the future holds, but it is not a great situation for DTM. At least the GT3 thing saves the series, and we'll see what that means for the future. Thank you for writing in, though, Walt. Final question from Edward Bighouse. Is Cadillac slowly dismissing its DPI program? He says it seems it is no longer supporting IMSA customers, and they have not said anything about an LMDH program. And again, will this, plus the first American Glickenhaus customer, push IMSA to be a bit more open about LMH cars?
Yeah, I think Cadillac is a bit of a question mark for LMDH right now. It's clear that there hasn't been much out of the GM camp on that. If GM was looking to reduce their presence in IMSA, you know, it would make sense to either get rid of one or the other. And I don't think you can get rid of Corvette Racing. There's just no way. We've had Corvette DPs in the top class before, but, could we see a Corvette LMDH? I don't know. But it would make sense for them to sort of stay in the GT ranks if there's enough all-pro lineups, if it ends up being more towards GT3. There's a lot of questions right now over what's going to happen. I am a little, but to be honest, I am concerned about Cadillac's long-term commitment and participation beyond the current DPI regs, because next year we will see at least one less Cadillac on the grid with the Wayne Taylor operation moving to Acura, and there's no indication of that being replaced by anybody at this point.
Okay. What do you think about any added pressure to let LMH run in the series?
I think it'll come down to who actually shows up with LMH cars. So if it's really Glickenhaus and Baikalis and Toyota, I don't see IMSA really pushing for that. It appears that Lexus, for what it's worth, it appears that Lexus is one of the leading candidates for an LMDH program. So I think, you know, that negates the need for a Toyota acceptance in LMH for IMSA. But then again, like as I said earlier in the show, if somebody like Hyundai would come in with an LMH, I think that would force IMSA's hand to allow LMH cars, or at least selected cars, into the WeatherTech Championship.
Okay. Great questions this week. Thank you, folks, for writing in. We really do appreciate it. Love the interaction. And if anyone else has questions for a future show, you can leave them in the comment section of this podcast or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter. Let's move on to previewing this weekend, and boy, is it a busy one, John. We've got Mobile One 12 Hours of Sebring, season finale for IMSA. We've got the World Endurance Championship finale in Bahrain, and we've got the GT World Challenge Europe powered by AWS finale at Paul Ricard, and puts a lot of strain on everybody, drivers and manufacturers and us in the media, fans as well. It really stretches the bandwidth when you've got so many significant races piled into one weekend.
Especially with all three being championship deciders, season finale events. We just had the entry list for, as we're recording this, for the GT World Challenge Endurance Cup at Paul Ricard. 40 cars there. I think that's a season low, or could be a series low. You know, usually you have 50, 60 cars, you know, for the Endurance Cup races. A couple teams have dropped off, including Rova Racing, for instance. Looking in Bahrain, they also have a series low grid of 24 cars as we're recording this. Just a pair of Toyotas and LMP1. A couple LMP2 entries have dropped off recently. Some late driver lineup changes. Check Sports Car 365 for that. But moving on to what we would sort of say is the bigger event of the weekend, or I guess it's not good to say what's bigger or not, but from a North American standpoint, at least the Mobile One 12 Hours of Sebring has always been one of the biggest races of the year. And we have that rescheduled event for this weekend and 31 cars there for the WeatherTech Championship season finale. Really looking forward to this one. We'll have extensive coverage. You'll be on site for the event, Ryan, so I'm sure you'll be getting all the news and notes from the paddock there. And looking forward to the final big weekend of the year for sports car racing. And I'm really glad we could get all this racing in amid the pandemic, because there's been a lot of question marks as the cases have risen both in Europe and the U.S. And really hats off to all the organizers for doing everything they can do to get as much racing in as they could this year.
Yeah, especially that Paul Ricard round. I mean, things we were hearing in the last couple of weeks were not particularly positive about the chances of getting that GT World Challenge Europe race in this weekend, but looking positive, at least as it stands here on Monday morning. Looking forward to getting to Sebring, that's for sure. 31 cars, like you said. We see Joey Hand back in the IMSA paddock for the first time in quite some time. He'll be with Meyer Shank Racing, standing in for Alvaro Parent, who has duties over in Europe this weekend. Also interesting to see Neil Johnny drafted into the Porsche GTLM lineup in their send-off race, final race for the Core Autosport run Porsche GTLM program. And interesting to see no major BOP changes. I think just a little additional fuel for the GTD Lamborghini, the only change headed into Sebring this weekend. So not a lot of drama there, which is a good thing. Can't wait to see how it plays out on the racetrack. We'll have full coverage of all the events we just talked about. It's going to be a jam-packed weekend, so make sure you stick with us. Sportscar 365 on the website, of course, also social media. We'll do our best to keep you informed on everything that will be happening this weekend, and we'll be back next week to recap it all with our next edition of the Double Stint Podcast. Talk to you then.